Tribeca,
the podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles, and critical believers.
RevLab.
Welcome to this episode of More Tribeca. I'm Carla Mauro, the Reverend of the Swiss Church in London, and I am with Laurine Redding, a Swiss fellow here in London who works for the Swiss government. Hi, Laurine.
Hi, Carla.
And in this podcast, we usually take you to places across London that mean something to us. And we have even done so during the lockdown due to the coronavirus. And then Laurine and I thought that we can actually now travel anywhere in the world we want, because we are recording from our living rooms. So today we are traveling to a kind of obvious place. We are taking you to Switzerland. And Laurine and I found out that we have a childhood place in common. We didn't know each other at the time, but we spent our holidays in Klosters and Davos. So that's where we're going today. We have a few other places as well we want to take you, but should we just start there? What do you think?
Yeah, let's start there. And now maybe you can also say that this is the east of Switzerland, Graubünden, so the very mountainous part of it. We chose places, Davos, Klosters, and also other places in Switzerland that have a connection to England. So we don't lose that focus, but we see what we can find between Switzerland and England in Graubünden. So how was your Klosters and Davos experience for the first time? Did you go there as a child?
We went there from really early childhood. My my granddad and my grandma, so my dad's parents, they were from Graubünden. My granddad, who was the theology professor I talked about already,
yes,
he was from Schiers, which is a bit further down in the Rhine Valley. And they had a flat, which now belongs to my dad. So we went there from very early, long before it became a really posh holiday resort and attracted crowds from Holland and Russia and England. That's where we used to go as children. And what about you? What brought you to Davos?
Similar. It's also my grandfather, so it's also a family story. As some of you might know, Davos was a sanatorium town. Don't know how to say that properly in English. So it's a place where up in the mountains where people were sent or went that had tuberculosis, for example. They thought that the good mountain air, the fresh mountain air, would help them cure that disease. And there were so many big hotels, clinics, where you could then stay when you had that illness. And my grandfather was one of them. So he had tuberculosis when he was young and went to Davos. And since those days, my family was then connected to the place and went back. And so when we were children, me and my brothers, we would always go to Davos for our holidays in the winter and, you know, go to the places like the Schatzalp, where that was typically one of those beautiful sanatorium places in the mountains. So I have very nice memories of those times.
And did you spend your lockdown reading Thomas Mann's Sauberberg? Because it's a really big book, isn't it? That would be the opportunity to read books. Actually, Davos, because we used to stay in Klosters, and Davos was kind of the bad weather destination for us. We went to either the swimming pool there, the indoor swimming pool, or we went to the cafes, have some cake there. And then later when the Kirchner Museum opened, we went to the museum. So Davos, I'm afraid to say, is a little bit the bad weather place.
And I have another memory of Klosters, and there we go to the link to the UK. Whenever we went to Davos, the train goes by Klosters. So it's like a few stops before. And Klosters was one of the favorite holiday places for the royal family.
Oh, I know.
Specifically,
I've got a thing of an anecdote to tell you about the royals in Klosters.
So who was it? So it's always Prince Charles and the kids, right? So William and
Harry. Well, Klosters was actually the Prince Charles and Diana's holiday place with the kids, yeah. And after their divorce, they stopped going to Klosters. I think very occasionally a royal turns up for a wedding or something, but they're now going to Verbier, I believe. So Klosters is kind of in the past in terms of royalhood, for English royalhood. I think there's probably just the memories with Diana.
But as children, we were always so excited when we came through with the train. We'd always look out when the Closters stop came and see whether we could spot the Royals somewhere in Closters. I think it never worked.
Royal spotting was one of our favourite hobbies, mine and my sister's. We were sometimes, I think on two occasions we were there when the Royals were there. And the house where our flat is on the hill just beyond the Walserhof, the hotel where they used to stay. And from our living room, we had view on the balconies of the Walserhof. And me and my sister, we used to look through the window with binoculars to see if we can spot them in the living rooms.
And did you? Were you able to?
Not through the windows. No, we did see them. So there was I remember there's a photo of my sister with Fergie in the background.
Oh wow!
When they had a photo shoot there's just next to the our house, there is a little ski slope. That doesn't exist now anymore.
Yeah.
But they had a little photo shoot there with Fergie and their family, her family. So that was one. And then I think there was actually once we went on Madriza and Prince Charles and the sons, Harry and William, they were literally two cabins. They were individual cabins going up on Madriza, and there were two cabins before me. And then when I came off it, there were 20 or so camera people. And wow. Obviously the Royals, and the slopes were just full with camera people running up and down. And it's just like ridiculous. But you know, that's the closest who ever came. And then I remember my my dad writing letters to the Royals. Once he wrote the letter to Prince Charles because he's in a lay orchestra. He's a violinist in a lay orchestra, and they played the March of Prince of Wales. Mm-hmm. And my dad wrote a letter to the palace because he knew that Prince Charles was on holiday in Closters at the time and invited him to come to the concert. And he got a letter back from the palace and saying, thank you very much for the invitation, but the prince has already left Switzerland.
Oh, would have been a great occasion.
Yeah. Yeah, but now it's not. Yeah, no, the Royals are not there anymore. They're not coming to Closters anymore. It's just us.
Just us, yeah.
Yeah. So there are a few other places in mm-hmm. Switzerland that have a UK connection. Actually, should we just stick with skiing? Because skiing was introduced by the British as a leisure activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know something about that?
I know that one of the starts where the skiing and the Royals connect was even earlier, was when Queen Victoria came to Switzerland. Have you heard about this in Luzern?
No, no.
So this might have been actually the start of Swiss tourism industry to begin with. So in the 19th century, at some point she decided she needs a break. And then the palace tried to organize, where should we go? Should we go to Austria for a break from her royal duties? But eventually they settled for Switzerland. And they went to Luzern, and Queen Victoria travelled by train through Paris and then came into Lucerne train station, and they tried to hide that it was the Queen. So they said it was another royal, but it was a very badly kept secret. So when the train arrived in Lucerne train station, there were crowds welcoming her to the city. And she actually stayed there for about a month and took loads of walks around, hiked up the mountains or hiked up on one of her ponies that was always with her, and spend a month there. And there's still, and from that moment, because it was very important, obviously, having the Queen in your city, there's now so many things. There was an exhibition about Queen Victoria. There are now Victoria hotels. There was even a ship
that is called, yeah, now this is the connection.
And that gave a huge boost to tourism in Switzerland. So lots of British people after that would come to Switzerland and to discover the mountains, to go skiing, etc.
And also, like, yeah, the skiing was a mean of transport before that for farmers to go down the snowy mountains. And it was the British who discovered it as a leisure activity, from what I know. And also the a lot of the first ascents, well, most famously the Matterhorn, the first ascent of the Matterhorn, that was a group of British climbers as well. So all these kind of leisurely or adventurous activities in Switzerland were indeed brought to Switzerland by the British.
And for those who don't know the Matterhorn, the British audience, just look on your next Toblerone package. That's the Matterhorn. Most iconic mountain of Switzerland.
Yeah. And in Zermatt, where the kind of Zermatt is where the place you would go to see the Matterhorn or to climb the Matterhorn if you're a mountain climber. And there you can find a lot of cultural references to the first to these British people who first went up the Matterhorn. And actually, you were talking about Lucerne, and something else popped to my mind.
Yes,
you know the Rigi, the mountain, one of the famous mountains on the Vierwaldstättersee, the Lake of Lucerne. The Rigi is a famous painting of William Turner. I think it's one of his most famous paintings. William Turner is one of the greatest, or at least, I mean, greatest in terms of art. I don't know, everyone has to judge for themselves, but definitely the most famous British painter. And he was in Switzerland as well. It seems like all Brits have been to Switzerland. And he painted the Rigi. He did three paintings of the Rigi. And the most famous one is the Blue Rigi, which is in the Tate Britain. So the Rigi. And actually, that's just another, on another note, a good friend of mine is the vicar in Sempach. You know Sempach? It's not far from Lucerne.
Yeah, it's also on the Lake of Lucerne.
I think he was the press officer, or the kind of press coordinator, manager for the Rigibahnen, for the Rigi trains, before he became a vicar in his second career, Hans. So here, a shout out to my friend Hans. So he knows the Rigi very well. And he comes to London with his confirmation class every year to the Swiss church. So there is some like a multi-layered connection between the Rigi and the Swiss church as well somehow.
Right, and there's not only painters, there's also writers who went to Switzerland, British writers. So for example, J.R. Tolkien.
Oh yeah, what's his connection?
So a lot of his books of The Lord of the Rings, it's actually quite funny, are places, it's obviously a fantasy world, but they're based around places in Switzerland because J.R.R. Tolkien loved Switzerland and travelled a lot around it. So, for example, I don't know how familiar you are with this story, Carla, but there's a place called Mordor in Lord of the Rings, which is sort of the place where the villain lives. And that was actually inspired by the Wallis in Switzerland, so that valley in the south. So there's lots of like fun facts of what could have been the inspirations of the places in Lord of the Rings from Switzerland.
Another famous British person who travelled Switzerland 200 years ago was the poet and politician Lord Byron. He travelled to various corners of Switzerland, and among them the beautiful Château de Chillon on the Lake of Geneva, which inspired his poem The Prisoners of Chillon. And the Château de Chillon is actually also one of my favourite spots in Switzerland. Lord Byron also travelled to Lauterbrunnen. That's a small village in the Bernese Alps. And from there, tourists from across the globe take a train up to the iconic mountains Eiger, Mönch and Jungfrau. There's a very international crowd passing through that village every day. Lord Byron stayed at the vicarage in Lauterbrunnen, and he also mentions the famous waterfalls in his travel reports. Here is the Reverend of Lauterbrunnen, Markus Janz, who will tell you more about the beautiful valley, the famous visitor, and his church's connection with the Swiss church in London.
Grüß euch, das ist der Markus Janz, Pfarrer zu Lauterbrunnen im schönen Berner Oberland. Ich stehe hier auf dem Balkon und sehe raus. Links und rechts grosse Felswände, hinter Berge und ein bisschen wildes Gebiet. Und ich sehe einfach das Wasser fliessen und höre das auch sehr gut. Das Wasser, das ist hier wichtig in diesem Tal mit 72 Wasserfällen. Und nebenzu ist der Staubbachfall. Der Staubbachfall hat schon den Lord Byron bewundert, der vor 200 Jahren, 1816, ist im Pfarrhaus übernachten konnte. Er hat den Staubbachfall wie folgt beschrieben: A long wild tale of the pale horse upon which death is mounted in the book of Revelations. Ja, eine wunderschöne Bezeichnung, ganz Nacht, wenn man sieht, bei Vollmond, klarem Sternenhimmel, wie näher so Silberfäden von den Felsen abhängen. Vor ein paar Jahren durften wir mit einer Jugendgruppe nach London gehen, an die Swiss Church, und sie herzlich willkommen geheissen worden von der Pfarrerin Carla Maurer. Wir durften sehen, wie Kirche in einer Grossstadt gelebt wird, wo Kirche nicht ganz so präsent ist, vielleicht wie das hier auf dem Land im Kanton Bern noch ist. Aber wir fühlen uns verbunden, die verschiedenen Arten von Kirche und auch mit den verschiedenen Arten von Sightseeing-Möglichkeiten, Sehenswürdigkeiten, sei es hier auf dem Land oder bei euch in der Stadt. Und vielleicht sehen wir uns mal hier zu Utterbrunnen oder bei euch zu London. Habt's gut, führt nach Gott. Auf Wiederhören.
And when you think about all that tourism and British tourism in Switzerland, you need to find a way of getting all these people to the mountains. And there again, we actually have to thank British engineers, because it was British engineers who built the Swiss railway system originally. It was led by Swiss entrepreneurs, but the actual, in 1850, just after the Swiss state was founded, it was the Swiss Federal Council, the government, asked British engineers to design the Swiss railway system, because back in the day, the British railways, unlike now, if I may say so, were excellent, were like the best in Europe. And so they came and designed the whole grid across Switzerland. So, for example, there's a funny story as well. Still today, Olten is like sort of the hub where all the Swiss railways go by and cross, where you can change and go anywhere. That was actually the idea by those British engineers, to have Olten as sort of the center of the net.
Oh,
and another fun thing, where you can still see today that it was designed by British engineers, is that unlike in other places in Europe, the trains go on the left-hand side instead of on the right-hand side.
Well, when they
as
cross
in the rest of Europe.
Yeah, the left.
The way it is built. Yeah.
left-hand traffic in Switzerland. I had no idea.
It's a bit hard to notice, but if you actually pay attention, it's quite funny to see.
Well, it kind of explains as well why there's so much movement between Switzerland and England. Right? I mean, there's so many flights and the trade relationships. I mean, talking about flights, not currently.
But I remember this fact from the embassy.
There's so much movement between...
Yeah, it's 70 flights every day between
70 flights?
Between Switzerland and the UK.
How many now? 3 or 4?
Probably, yeah.
We hope to catch one of those soon.
Let's try.
Yeah. Well, that was great to go to Switzerland with you, Laurine. And I hope
Likewise.
We can do very soon in real.
Yes, let's try soon. And then maybe we can record one in Switzerland as well.
That'd be great.
Carla, what's the role of social media in church?
That's interesting. You would have asked me that question 3 or 4 months ago. I think the answer probably would have been a bit different.
You mean before the coronavirus crisis?
Before the coronavirus crisis, yeah, because that really changed how things are being done. I mean, not just in the church, but everywhere. Everything went online. I mean, staff meetings and concerts and everything, including church services. A lot of churches now use a live stream. I do all the audio services myself, and we also have a team meeting every Tuesday on Zoom. And obviously social media. I mean, in a way, the good thing is, I think what this crisis shows is that churches already were very well connected online. A lot of ministers or church congregations do use social media, some better than others. I mean, it takes a lot of time to do it well. So, but it really showed that churches do use social media and also text message for counseling, for instance. And in the past few weeks, it's really incredible how churches really quickly adapted to the new circumstances and were able to reach out to people in these ways.
What does that mean concretely? What tools do you use for what purpose, especially now in the corona times?
Well, I think one of the big things was about the Sunday services, because suddenly we weren't able, no church now is able to meet in person. And meeting in person, I mean, that's so, so important for any faith group, really. I think the first question churches ask themselves is, what can we do on Sunday morning instead of meeting at the church?
Yeah.
So there is a combination. Some do live streaming. I personally think live streaming only makes sense if you have a small camera team and you can make it visually interesting, because otherwise you just have a talking head there. So it depends how you do it. Others do kind of Zoom prayers. You know, you can kind of click in on Zoom and you have like a faith talk with the minister and a cup of coffee in the hand. Mm-hmm. And I, for instance, do audio services. So it's kind of more like a podcast. But for the simple reason as well, I'm really lucky because my husband is a record producer and has his sound studio in the house. So we can produce that quite easily. And it's actually quite fun to do that with him. So we're doing it that way. And then the other one, very big question is counseling, because one of the things churches do is counseling, talking to people who are in a crisis or need someone to talk to. And how do you do that? Ministers and church employees or church congregations, they use the phone a lot at the moment, calling up people. There are even like churches who just go through the list of members and call every single person just to check in with them. I kind of use WhatsApp quite a bit to do counseling on WhatsApp, because for some people they prefer writing rather than talking, at least as a first step. So that's another way to do that. And you know, a lot of movements on Facebook as well, and on Instagram. So a lot of things are happening. Really.
So counseling, the Sunday service or other services, what about community work? Sort of the projects that you do with the church, for the community, together with the community. How does that work now, and do you use social media in that regard as well?
Yeah, I think there's some things who can't be replaced or can't be done on social media. And I think community work or look after people in need, that's basically impossible. So I think in that area, a lot of churches came up with kind of physical activity, something to replace their services. I know of a church in Switzerland, for instance, they borrowed from the council a fence, like a metal fence. Yeah. And then they put on, like, people could come and bring plastic bags with goods in the plastic bag and hang them on the fence. And people in need could just come and grab it. And that was to replace their lunchtime, the kind of lunch they had for people in need. So I think when it comes to community work, you can't really replace it. You have to come up with practical solutions. And at the Swiss church, we don't have the resources to continue our homeless breakfast. So the only thing at the moment we can do is to give the money that we usually spend for our homeless service to other charities and to other churches in the area who still run their services. And we are thinking about practical steps, what we could do to support people in need, especially homeless people in central London. At the moment, it's just the financial support we do to other churches. Right. Mm. And then the other thing you can't do, and that's very sad, is that weddings are being cancelled, confirmations are being cancelled, and funerals can only take
funerals, place. Funerals I've heard take place in a different form, right? So how does a funeral work now?
So in the UK, throughout the lockdown and still now, you're allowed to have 10 people in the chapel. up to 10 people, including the minister and the funeral director. And in Switzerland, I think it was similar. You could just do it with a very few people. Now they opened up a little bit more. So you can do funerals, but you have to just leave out a lot of people who would otherwise come. And I think what we do, I had one funeral so far. And it was because he was a very, very old person. He was over 90. And the people who would have come are in vulnerable group. So I recommended not to come. And we live streamed it. At the funeral director put up a live stream so people could watch at home. And I was actually on my own in the chapel with the coffin.
And, all by yourself?
Yeah, all by myself with good old Albert, who was the longest standing church member. We talked about him, actually. We talked about him at the Greyfriars churchyard. So he sadly passed away, and I was all by myself with him. Well, with him deceased. And we will do something next year sometime when we will be able to safely meet again. We will do a big celebration of his life at the Swiss church. So not everything can... And I think basically, I mean, at the moment what we see is really certain things can be done on social media and online, and others just can't be replaced.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I think we need this human contact. I think we all feel this now. As humans, we need the social part. It's essential to us. It doesn't work just to replace it digitally somehow.
Mm. How do you feel about that whole kind of online, you know, going online and meeting people on the Zoom or FaceTime and all that? Is that something you do?
Yeah, I do it a lot for my work, and I think like many of us also for social, you know, in the evening to meet friends for a virtual drink or to play games or just to hang out. I have lots of pub quizzes that I go to. I go to so many more pub quizzes than I would go outside of the lockdown. There's like a pub quiz every week almost, or two a week that I attend.
What is the best pub quiz? Because I was thinking about it. Do you have any recommendations?
They're not like... They're all from friends.
Oh, so right. So you're doing your own pub quizzes.
Yeah, we do our own pub quizzes. It's quite fun. It's like a homemade version. It's quite... So we do it a lot where just like every group who participates comes up with some questions to ask the others. Or we do like... yesterday we did one with a little scavenger hunt around the house. So I think this is actually quite fun. I do things that I wouldn't do otherwise. But on the whole, I think there's like a maximum amount of Zoom calls I want to do or can do every day. And at some point I just, you know, want to be away from the screen. Mm. And then I, you know, try to do some gardening or go for a run or just something away, cooking.
What do you think is the difference between, you know, meeting like that, and what is the thing that is missing?
That's a really good question. I wondered a lot. I was thinking, I mean, one part for sure you can still say, okay, is the quality of the video and the sound. You know, that you can't hear someone very well, or you can't see the gestures or the expressions of the face as well. But if you think even further, I'm thinking, you know, if you had the perfect internet connection and a great software that you can see everything, hear everything well, what would be missing then? Maybe it's even in a hologram. What would be missing then? And I'm really not sure. I wonder what it is about the human connection. I mean, there's something maybe about that you want to shake someone's hand or hug someone that gives you a different connection to that person. Or is it maybe the pheromones, the scent, something that, you know, we perceive about other humans only in person that we are lacking when it's a digital connection? I'm not really sure, but I'm convinced there is something missing.
I read something. I sadly couldn't find, unfortunately, I couldn't find the article anymore, but I read something about it does something to our brain, apparently. I tried to remember correctly, that somehow our brain takes the input as, oh, I'm in a social situation, I'm talking to this person, mm-hmm. but there is a kind of a contradictory input of it, probably what you say with the smell or that person being in the room, or also if you speak on the computer, you don't look directly in the eyes. And right. the reactions, so the kind of body language is somehow delayed, or you can't see the whole body or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so our brain receives two contradictory messages that you are in a social situation, but you are not. Mm-hmm. And apparently that really tires the brain. And I don't know, I mean, I could really associate with that because I find these online talking so tiring with the visual ones. Mm-hmm. I kind of... In the first few weeks, I did quite a bit of it and I found it so tiring. I'm back to audio now. I talk to people on the phone as I did before. I don't know. Then I can look into my garden like I do now as I talk to you. And mm-hmm. I don't know. It's not. It's nicer in a way.
Yeah, no, I get you.
Generally, I think social media and all the opportunities we have at the moment, I mean, this lockdown is so much better because of it. And I'm That's so grateful true. For the technology. I'm not at all, I'm not at all against it all, but I find also there are limitations to it that I think that we really see now in this situation. But I think it's great to relate, because for a lot of people, it's actually difficult to go into social situation and they are anxious in social situations. And I think, in church is something we perhaps don't consider enough, that going into a church or joining a congregation or joining a meeting can be a really big step, or even talking mm-hmm. To a minister face to face can be too much for certain people. And that's why I think if you have like social media, like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or you have WhatsApp conversation, I'm a big fan of WhatsApp counseling, because I think it's a kind of a low, how do you say that in English? A niederschwellig.
Niederschwellig,
a low key start into a conversation for people who find it really difficult to go into a real one-to-one conversation or into a group of people. And I think that's really something I think is a great opportunity about all these about technology and about social media we have nowadays. And I mean, a lot of counseling for me starts with text message conversations, for instance, or like having discussions on Facebook, and then maybe that can develop into a one-to-one conversation, but it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. And I think for people, it's a way to connect with church, but they don't necessarily want to go into the social situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that has been exactly like that before. And now we can really aus dem vollen schöpfen, as you say in German. We can use all
make
that.
Make best use of this.
Yeah, make best use of what we've already done before. Of course, also, yeah, with more, some churches more or less. And I think you have to be the type. And when it comes, I mean, me personally, I find on one hand it's a great opportunity, but I also I find it tiring. And I think not everyone feels the same way, but I find it's kind of conversation on social media or the use of social media very tiring, because I feel like as a minister, I feel one of the of my main tasks or what I should do is to have time for people and to talk to people and also to have time for myself, because I can only be a good minister if I look after myself. Yeah. And I look after my own spiritual development. And the problem with these technologies and social media is it eats into that time. And you can very easily be distracted and being drawn into that busyness. You know, always doing something, always being in conversation, always being online.
Do you have a rule for yourself? How do you manage your social media? Do you sometimes turn it off? Or how are you, you know, finding that space and time for yourself as well?
Definitely one rule is that I don't do social media or anything off in the evening. I'm very quite strict. After like 7 or 8, I switch off my phone.
And then no more telephone after 7 or 8.
Yeah.
No more social media on your computer either. No Facebook, nothing, Twitter.
No, very rarely. I mean, yes, there are times when it's still on, or there are times when I use the phone for phone calls. But very often I put it away. And social media I really try to avoid. But then there are times when I feel drawn into it. It's almost like, it can be a... You can feel the addiction of it, right? I mean, I can feel that quite well. And sometimes I get into that addiction. And what I then do is just to tell my my husband to make me aware of it and just to
take
help
your phone
me.
Away. Or
yes, yeah. As I say, you have to help me. I'm getting addicted, and that works quite well. And yeah. Funnily enough, since the lockdown, I use it much less. I'm much less on social media. That's kind of a thing.
We are all full of contradictions. Life is full of contradictions like these as well. But I so often like find myself looking at the phone the first thing in the morning and also looking at my phone before I go to sleep. And I really want to change that as well. I don't think it's very healthy as well.
Ban the phones from the bedroom. I'm a big advocate of that. Ban your phones from the bedroom.
But I need it for the alarm clock. How do you do that?
Well, you know what? You can just buy a very... That's actually one thing I did because I used my phone... as an alarm clock, and I was in that trot, and I don't know if trot is an English word, but like
we make it an English word now. We'll introduce
it. and I bought an alarm clock. It solves the problem. I used the audio services to try and say something and invite people to also share their thoughts in the audio services. So they're quite a lot of people just record voice messages on WhatsApp and just send it to me, and then they become part of the audio services. And I also invite ministers from different countries who just send in their sermons or their thoughts. And I love it. I love doing audio services because I can include so many people, and almost everyone nowadays has a smartphone, and they can just send in something and it sounds good, you know? So I'm a big fan of audio. And also maybe just to mention for those, we have a few people over 90 or in the late 80s who don't have internet access, and I print it out for them and send it via post. So they're also kind of part of it and can read the words. I think that's very, very important. But interestingly enough, that people in the 70s and 80s here in our congregation, they're very good with technology. I think it has to do because they are away from their families. And in order to be in contact with family in Switzerland or across the world, they use, they kind of use these technologies and they know how to do that. So I'm in the lucky situation that even though our congregation is in their 70s, 80s, most of them, most of them are perfectly able to listen to the audio service. So that's really great. I hope I answered the question, or at least shared thoughts about this question. Looking forward to talk to you soon again. Bye.
And now for some music from our brilliant organist, Peter Yardley-Jones.